Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Paul Moss, and in the early hours of Sunday, the 9th of June, these are our main stories. The European Union's High Representative has strongly condemned the killing of Palestinians in Gaza on Saturday. It happened during Israel's military operation to free four hostages. The Israeli Prime Minister, Benjamin Netanyahu, said the rescue had proved that Israel did not surrender to terrorism. And the French President, Emmanuel Macron, and his US counterpart, Joe Biden, have stressed the enduring strength of the alliance between the two countries. Also in this podcast...
The best time of my entire life. I'm 100 years old and my bride is 96.
The D-Day veteran who returned to Normandy and got married. The European Union has condemned in the strongest terms the killing of Palestinians during an Israeli military operation in Gaza on Saturday. Hostages held by Hamas were rescued from a refugee camp. But during the process, there was what the EU's High Representative Josep Borrell called a massacre of civilians. The operation involved airstrikes and intense gun battles with Hamas in and around the Nuseirat refugee camp. But the Israeli Prime Minister, Benjamin Netanyahu, focused on the Israelis who'd been freed.
Israel just carried out a remarkable rescue operation of four hostages held by Hamas. This operation required ingenuity and courage of the highest degree, and our soldiers performed in an unmatchable way. We're committed to getting the release of all the hostages, and we expect Hamas to release them all. But if they don't, we'll do whatever it takes to get them all back home. Hamas is committing war crimes every day, including the holding of these hostages. Our soldiers are performing in the most valiant and moral way to end this war with a victory against these killers and against these kidnappers, and we shall prevail.
Mr. Netanyahu met families of the rescued hostages, including the mother of 21-year-old Almog Meir Jan.
Thank you for bringing my son to me, to us. I'm so excited that I could hug him today.
Israeli campaigners have been holding regular protests demanding their government do more to get the hostages released. And on Saturday, thousands were out again on the streets of Tel Aviv. And there is, as usual, dispute over the number of Palestinians killed in this latest Israeli operation. A single hospital says it counted 70 bodies. Hamas claims more than 200 Palestinians were killed and 400 wounded, with women and children among them. This man was searching for casualties among the rubble.
The Israelis allowed women and children to enter the house. Then they hit it. You know, we don't know which body belongs to who. They're in pieces. Nobody is in one piece.
We'll be getting more Arab reaction in a moment, but with details of the operation still emerging, I asked our correspondent in Jerusalem, John Donison, what we know so far.
We don't know the details of the number of people killed, but we certainly saw some pretty grim images coming out of the hospitals in central Gaza, and it's clear that the Israelis used a lot of force to achieve what they say was a very successful operation.
So it does seem that whatever the number of Palestinians killed was, that they did die during the course of the operation to free those hostages.
That certainly seems to be the case. The raid happened on two apartments fairly close together in Nusrat, which is a very densely populated camp in the centre of Gaza. But in the run-up to it, there was pretty heavy bombardment by tanks and also airstrikes, and it's not clear how the Palestinians were killed, whether they were immediately in the vicinity of the raid or in the build-up to it.
Now, the Israeli Prime Minister, Benjamin Netanyahu, has been under serious pressure to get hostages released. Do you think this rescue buys him time? Does it take the pressure off? Or is he still under pressure because so many hostages remain in captivity?
I think it eases the pressure for the moment. It will allow Benjamin Netanyahu to say, look, his strategy is working. He believes that the best way to get the hostages out of Gaza, and there remain 116 being held there who were taken on October the 7th, 40 of whom are thought to be dead. He thinks the best way is to put pressure on Hamas militarily, and this operation will allow him to say that that is working. The Israeli military, when we spoke to them today, they gave a briefing. They said that a deal remained the best way to get a large number of hostages out, but there is no sign of that deal, a ceasefire deal with Hamas. There's no sign of that being in the offing.
The war cabinet minister, Benny Gantz, had given Saturday as the deadline for Benjamin Netanyahu to come up with a plan for Gaza long term. If that didn't emerge, he said he was going to resign. What's happened with that?
Well, that press conference by Benny Gantz was scheduled for late Saturday evening, and it was called off at fairly short notice. Now, we have had Benjamin Netanyahu tweeting this evening that this is the time for unity and not for division. I call on Benny Gantz, don't leave the emergency government, don't give up on unity. And then just moments later, a response from Mr. Gantz. He said, alongside the justified joy in the achievement, we must remember that all the challenges Israel faces have remained as they were. And therefore, he said to Mr. Netanyahu and the leadership that we must consider responsibly how it is best and possible to continue from here. So I think he's leaving the door open there to carry through on his threat to resign, although he hasn't specifically said that at this point.
John Donison. So, political manoeuvring in Israel. Meanwhile, in Gaza, the aftermath of the Israeli airstrikes. Survivors like this woman struggling to understand what had happened.
We don't know what happened. We were sitting peacefully and all of a sudden we heard the strikes. We were 50 people hiding there and saw missiles flying over our heads. Nobody is protecting us. The Red Cross doesn't protect us. Nobody does. We don't know where are our children. We lost our children and spouses. And here we are getting displaced for the third time, not knowing where to go.
Hamas claims that during the course of the rescue operation, Israel also killed some of the other hostages. Still, Israel defended its action. Military spokesman Peter Lerner insisting it was Hamas who were to blame for what had happened.
Every civilian life lost in this war is a deep tragedy. It's a tragedy, nevertheless, that Hamas are responsible because they initiated this war on the October 7th attack, and they intentionally positioned all of their assets, including our hostages, within the civilian population.
The Hamas-run health ministry has updated its overall death toll in Gaza. It says that more than 36,000 people have been killed since the October attacks. Our Middle East regional editor, Mike Thompson, has been monitoring what they've said about dealing with the casualties from the Israeli strikes on Saturday.
They're saying that there's a great shortage of medicines, including anaesthetics and that sort of thing, and medical staff. And it's just the sheer weight of people, the weight of numbers. And of course, this is the case across Gaza, where there are not many now medical facilities available to the many, many people who need them.
I'm told that President Mahmoud Abbas has called it this a bloody massacre, and he wants an urgent UN meeting to discuss what happened. Any sign whether that's going to happen or not?
Not as yet. Yes, he wants the Security Council to hold a special session to look into this. If this is granted, this would come off the back of the International Court of Justice, the ICJ's decision earlier this year, in which it ordered a ceasefire to take place in Gaza. Now, of course, as we see, sadly, that hasn't happened. So you do wonder that even if the Security Council has this meeting, what would it actually be able to result in?
And what about Israel's neighbours, Egypt and Jordan? What about Saudi Arabia, other allies of the Palestinian cause? What have they said?
Well, they've been saying for some time now that Israel's reaction to Hamas in Gaza is disproportionate. They've been saying that when you look at the number of people killed, in the case of rescuing hostages, as we saw today, they're saying it's a very small number and so many civilians are dying. Of course, we heard the Israeli response to that earlier, where they say, well, if Hamas insists on housing hostages in areas of high civilian density, then that's going to happen. But overall, what they want is a permanent ceasefire. And of course, for that to happen, we need peace talks to succeed. And at the moment, they're completely deadlocked.
Mike Thompson. Now to other news. The US and France have certainly had their ups and downs over the years. They shared a mutual revolutionary fervour back in the 18th century. France later gifting America the Statue of Liberty. Fast forward a couple of centuries, though, and the two fell out over Iraq and over an aborted submarine deal. But the war in Ukraine seems to have refocused minds. Joe Biden has been in France for celebrations to mark the anniversary of the World War II Operation D-Day. And Saturday saw him being warmly welcomed in Paris by the President, Emmanuel Macron.
It is this bloodline that is the connection between our two flags, our two nations. So once again, thank you for your presence. Together with the President, we discuss the great issues that we are facing, the first of which being Ukraine. Today in Ukraine, men and women are fighting with remarkable courage.
So, what's going on beneath the warm words? Is this just the usual diplomatic bonhomie? Or are Washington and Paris really best buddies once again? From Paris, Hugh Schofield reports.
Before an audience of dignitaries and under a cloudless blue sky, President Macron welcomed his American counterpart at the Arc de Triomphe. Together, they laid a wreath and rekindled the flame over the tomb of the unknown soldier. They were then driven down the Champs-Élysées, accompanied by cavalry of the Republican Guard, to the Élysée Palace for a working lunch. This afternoon, the two leaders appeared together before the news media, with President Biden stressing once again the theme of this D-Day week, the need to stand up to Russia today, just as the Allies stood up to Germany 80 years ago.
This week, we have showed the world once again the power of allies, what we can achieve when we stand together. That's what this relationship between France and the United States exemplifies. You know, we see it in Ukraine, where our two countries are standing with the Ukrainian people as they fight off Putin's brutal aggression.
This evening, there's been a state dinner at the Elysee.
Hugh Schofield. A major battle in Somalia has seen both sides claiming victory. Fighters from the Islamist extremist group Al-Shabaab carried out a dawn attack on bases held by government troops and allied militia in the town of El Deir. Al-Shabaab said the operation had succeeded. The Somali government insisted the attack had been repelled. Here's Will Ross.
The Somali government says the army was aware of an imminent attack and withdrew troops. It says an ambush and an airstrike killed more than 40 Islamist militants and five soldiers died. Al-Shabaab said dozens of soldiers were killed in the raid and posted photos of its fighters inside a base. 2 years ago, the government launched an offensive to capture areas of central and southern Somalia held by the militants. After some initial success, Al-Shabaab regrouped and recaptured some of that territory. The latest fighting highlights the country's insecurity as thousands of African Union peacekeepers are getting ready to pull out of Somalia by the end of the year.
Will Ross. There's a dizzying array of possible outcomes from South Africa's election last week. With no party winning a majority, some kind of coalition will have to be cobbled together. But that won't be easy, with bitter ideological and personal differences between the major players. What's certain, though, is that the previously unchallenged status of the African National Congress has now been swept away, with the party for the first time getting less than half the votes. And as Barbara Plett-Usher explains, that's a bitter blow for those who devoted their lives to the ANC and its struggle against apartheid.
We shall build a society in which all South Africans, both black and white, will be able to walk tall without any fear in their hearts.
Nelson Mandela, 30 years ago, heralding the vision of a new South Africa in his inaugural speech as the country's first black president. Last week, his party, the African National Congress, was punished at the polls for not delivering it.
I've been a member of the ANC for 66 years, so understandably, I'm very disappointed.
This is Mavuso Mtsamang, an ANC veteran who was on the front lines of the struggle against apartheid.
Would you say this is the end of an era?
It marks a very important point in the life of the organization. The fact that for the first time we aren't able to win the majority of votes. And the reason for that is that we have not heeded the pleas of the people. Namely, that we are suffering from the existence of corrupt people in your ranks.
The ANC was up against a lot when it gained power in 1994. But because of corruption and economic mismanagement, it didn't fully reverse inequalities embedded by white minority rule, even though it did end racial segregation.
It brought liberation to this country, and there were lots of expectations from Africa that some of the disappointments that have happened after liberation would not occur here.
The decline that we see from the polls, what does that mean for that legacy?
Yes, I don't know how it will be retrieved. I hope this is not forever.
Right now, what it means is tricky power-sharing talks, because the major players have very different visions for the country.
Nobody must force us. Well, the results are not correct. People will be provoking us. Don't start trouble.
There's the MK party of former President Jacob Zuma, which hasn't accepted the election results.
Principle and demands will include the following: amendment of the constitution to realize land expropriation without compensation in
the Marxist Economic Freedom Fighters, or EFF, who want to nationalize mines and seize white-owned land.
The DA will make it our number one priority to prevent an ANC-EFF doomsday coalition from
and the pro-business
power.
Democratic Alliance, unquote, with a free market agenda. Analyst Sanusha Naidu is skeptical of fears that a government, including a radical party like the EFF, could trigger economic disaster.
I think you're not going to get that kind of two extremes. And that uncertainty, I think, is what will happen for those who want to disrupt the political landscape.
Those who have the most at stake are young people. So I've come to one of Johannesburg's biggest universities, Witwatersrand, to ask students what they think about this new future.
My name is Nobuhle Khumalo.
My name is Lerato Siba.
The ANC has lost its majority. What do you think this means for South Africa?
I'm not sure what it looks like because it's new. And I think that's the biggest thing about this year, is that it seems like everybody just want to change.
For the country, I think a majority of the people at the moment were quite scared. So I think that's just kind of that fear. Like, we don't know what's going to happen, but we know we want a change.
The shape of South Africa's new government will determine that future. Much depends on it.
Barbara Plett-Usher. Still to come.
At the moment, we tend to rely on either seeing that somebody's not doing very well on memory tests or showing that their brain has shrunk on a brain scan to help us make the diagnosis.
Scientists think they've made progress in predicting the onset of dementia, and by nearly a decade before the disease starts to take hold. This is the Global News Podcast. Now, how's this for inflation? Egypt is quadrupling the price of bread. The government has slashed the subsidy it provides for what is to many people a crucial source of nutrition. Around two-thirds of Egyptians rely on buying bread at a reduced cost. This sudden leap in price has come about because the authorities had put off making any changes to the subsidy for many years. Perhaps because the last time they tried it, there were riots. From the Egyptian capital, Cairo, here's Sally Nabil.
No Egyptian family can do without bread. Egyptians refer to bread as elayish, or livelihood. It's a unique term in the Arab world that sums up how indispensable bread is in every Egyptian meal. This basic item has always been subsidized by different governments, who avoided arousing public anger. But under the current military-backed president, Abdel Fattah el-Sisi, the government has raised the price of subsidized bread by 300% in one go. Nearly two-thirds of more than 100 million Egyptians depend on subsidized bread. The fourfold rise in prices will burden many households who already struggle to put food on the table. Over the past years, the government has implemented a set of austerity measures that have totally or partially lifted subsidies of basic commodities like food and fuel. The authorities see this as part of its so-called economic reforms. The people we spoke to disagree to this argument, but they sounded helpless.
No matter how much I earn, I feel I'm not alive. I can't afford to eat what I like.
Nothing is more important than bread. But what can we do? This is how our life is now.
When the price of subsidised bread rises, the price of non-subsidised bread will go up too. It's already 150 piastres per loaf.
The price of subsidised bread was last raised in 1988, when it more than doubled in cost to its current price. Since then, it remained unchanged, but the size has been shrinking. When President Sisi took power in 2014, a loaf of bread went down from 130 grams to 120. That's around 4.5 ounces. It continued to decrease until it reached 90 grams, or just over 3 ounces, in 2020. Let's weigh in this small loaf of bread and see. What? It's not even 90 grams. It's only 75. Egypt is already suffering from huge budget deficit and crippling debts. It's on its fifth loan from the International Monetary Fund, making it one of the largest borrowers from the IMF. In a cabinet meeting, Egyptian Prime Minister Mustafa Madbouly said downsizing bread subsidies was inevitable.
A loaf of bread cost the government 125 piastres, and it sold for 5. So the government shoulders the burden of 120 piastres. If we multiply that by 100 billion loaves per year, we're talking here about 120 billion Egyptian pounds.
Successive governments have always argued food subsidies eat up a big chunk of the state's budget, but they have been quite cautious when it comes to bread prices. In 1977, late President Anwar Sadat took the risk of raising bread prices. The result was wild protests and riots that swept across the country. Eventually, he had to back off. The state might save millions of dollars from raising bread prices, but this will come with a cost. Many people will see a further squeeze to their budgets, and it's not clear how they will react.
Sally Nabil. Dementia causes misery around the world, both for the 55 million who suffer from the condition and perhaps even more for those who care for them. But dementia is also a killer. According to the World Health Organization, it's the planet's seventh leading cause of death. Work to find a cure has been slow, with plenty of false hopes quickly dashed. But now scientists think they've made progress, at least in predicting dementia's onset, and by nearly a decade before the disease starts. It involves better memory tests and also measurements of brain shrinkage. James Copnell spoke to Professor Charles Marshall, who led the research at Queen Mary University in London.
So we know that when people develop problems with their memory and go and see their doctor and get a diagnosis of dementia, their brain has been changing for 10 to 20 years by that time. And at the moment, we tend to rely on either seeing that somebody's not doing very well on memory tests or showing that their brain has shrunk on a brain scan to help us make the diagnosis. But before those things are evident, the way that the different regions of the brain talk to each other starts to be affected by the loss of brain cells in dementia. And that's what we were able to show in this study. So we looked at functional brain scans. So that's when somebody's lying in a brain scanner and the MRI scan is able to pick up how active different regions of the brain are. And we can use that to show how strongly connected the brain regions are. And we were able to show that the strength of connections between brain regions could predict who was going to get dementia up to 9 years in the future. What we would really like to do is to find treatments that we can give people that can prevent them from losing brain cells and prevent them from developing dementia, because once people lose brain cells, we can't replace them. And so we would like to be able to treat the condition as early as possible, ideally even before people get symptoms. So what I hope is that this might allow us to have a better way of finding people who are at risk of developing dementia, to go into trials of treatment so that we can find those things that are going to change the situation that we have at the moment, where there is no effective treatment available to people.
This then requires quite expensive technology, an MRI scanner, that sort of thing. It's not something perhaps readily available all around the world.
No, that's right. It does require an MRI scanner, but it could be done on any MRI scanner. So certainly here in the UK, an MRI scan tends to be a standard part of the process for getting a dementia diagnosis at the moment. And a typical MRI scan would take about 30 to 40 minutes. And this part is about 6 minutes of additional MRI scanning. So not hugely infeasible to build this in if we were able to show with more research that it would be helpful in that setting.
And I suppose for people like you who work on this sort of topic, on dementia and all its rather horrible effects, this is a pretty exciting moment.
We're very excited. We know that, you know, we would like to dream of a future where we can do things to protect people's brains from dementia, and we need to identify who the right people are to give those sorts of treatments to. And so this sort of thing could be the first step on the road towards being able to do that.
Professor Charles Marshall of London's Queen Mary University. Now, does Japan want people to view Mount Fuji or not? Last month, we were reporting that authorities had put up a barrier in a town near the mountain to stop people taking pictures from there. Apparently, locals have been complaining that there were too many tourists. But now comes news that a 10-story building is being demolished because it's blocking the view of Mount Fuji. Mickey Bristow has this story.
Before the condominium went up, there was a clear view of the famous peak, including its summit, right along a main street in the city of Kunitachi near Tokyo. Indeed, the road itself is called Mount Fuji View. Once the apartment block was built, though, half the mountain was obscured. Local residents have been complaining about the loss of their view since work on the building began. Meetings were held and the developer agreed to adjust the design, but the row rumbled on. Now, suddenly, the builders decided to tear the whole structure down just before its first residents were due to move in. The firm said it hadn't properly considered the impact on the surrounding landscape, leaving the residents of Mount Fuji View to continue enjoying the unspoilt sight of one of Japan's most memorable images.
Mickey Bristow. Now, speaking of photography, it was one of the most famous snaps ever taken, certainly one of the most famous taken in space. The year was 1968, and the American astronaut William Anders pointed his camera out of the window of his Apollo spacecraft and shot an iconic image of planet Earth, half lit by the sun, floating in the midst of the solar system's darkness, just as scientists always knew it did, but in a way that only that view from a distance could really capture. Well, William Anders has been killed in an aeroplane accident. He was 90 years old. US media report he'd been flying a small plane which crashed into the sea off Washington State. Here we have the moment he took the picture, and also Bill Anders later telling the BBC how he remembered it.
Oh my God, look at that picture over there. There's the Earth coming up. Wow, is that pretty.
Suddenly, out of my window, I called out that the wow, look at that, and the others poked their noses out the window, or in the windows too. So here was this beautiful planet coming up over a rather stark lunar horizon. And after three orbits in lunar orbit, we had all basically decided that the moon was a pretty boring place. I mean, it was nothing but a bunch of holes, churned up battlefield. And so here was this only color in the universe, as it was contrasted by the stark moon. And so I got a camera with a long lens and color film and started snapping pictures of the moon, one of which turned out to be what has become the iconic Earthrise photo.
You got a color film, Jim? Hand me a roll of color quick.
Oh,
will you?
Man, that's crazy. Where is it?
Quick.
Take several of them.
Take several of them. Here, give it to me. Wait a minute. Let's get the right setting here. Let's calm down. Hey, calm down, Mama.
Oh, I got it right. Oh, that's a beautiful shot.
Bill Anders. Well, my BBC colleague Lauren Taylor spoke to Leroy Chow, a fellow former astronaut who was once commander of the International Space Station. He paid Bill Anders this tribute.
Very nice man, but also very serious. The consummate astronaut and pilot. You know, he went on and lived a very full life. He ran General Dynamics after he left NASA and continued to fly airplanes. He turned 90 earlier this year and was still, by all accounts, sharp as a tack and very physically active and, of course, still flying. And so it's sad that he died in a plane crash, but, you know, he lived a full life and was doing what he loved.
And tell us what you think his legacy will be.
Well, certainly the Apollo 8 mission was a very daring mission, a very bold mission, kind of conceived, you know, very late in the game for the launch as far as mission planning goes. And it was a gamble that the Americans, the United States, took to go ahead and go around the moon with the Apollo spacecraft because our lunar lander wasn't ready yet. And so, as you pointed out, Bill took that iconic Earthrise picture that is still seen all the time. I've used it myself, and he will be remembered and missed by all of us, but especially among us professional astronauts.
And Bill Anders said about that moment when he took the photo, he said, we came all this way to explore the moon, and the most important thing that we discovered was the Earth. What are your reflections? I mean, you've been one of the rare people who's actually been in space. Tell us about what that's like.
Sure, absolutely. I mean, there's nothing better when you're in space than to look back at the Earth and marvel at the beauty of our planet. Every part looks different in its own way, and it's much more colorful and vibrant than you might imagine. The Apollo astronauts so far are the only ones who have seen Earth in its entirety when they, go far enough away to see it. Because since the Apollo program, of course, all astronauts have been in low Earth orbit. But still, we didn't quite get the perspective they did. But, flying in low Earth orbit for, 2/3 of a year or so, I did get to see a lot of it and understand what he meant by those words.
The former astronaut, Leroy Chow. As we heard earlier in the podcast, last week saw the 80th anniversary of the D-Day landings, when Allied soldiers stormed the beaches of Normandy in northern France to begin the process of liberating Europe from Nazi occupation. Among those at the commemoration ceremonies were many who'd taken part in the operation. But the occasion was particularly momentous for one American veteran. 100-year-old Harold Terrans used the opportunity to marry his 96-year-old fiancée. Ella Bicknell reports.
Sporting a light blue suit, a pink rose and his military medal, a gleeful Harold Terrans walked down the aisle towards his bride. The 100-year-old from Florida was in Normandy for D-Day celebrations, where he served as a radio technician, assisting fighter pilots in the skies over northern France. He wanted to commemorate the event by marrying his 96-year-old fiancée, Jean Swerlin. They tied the knot in the small town of Carentan-les-Marais, near the very beaches the Allies landed on 80 years ago.
My religion is love. I believe in love. I taught my family, wherever they go, just love.
Mr. Terrans was awarded the French Legion of Honour by President Macron in 2019. During the war, he was also part of a secret mission that took him to Soviet Ukraine via Casablanca, Algeria, Tunisia, Libya, Cairo, Baghdad, as well as Tehran. But he said Normandy will always have a place in his heart.
The best time of my entire life. I'm 100 years old and my bride is 96. Normandy is my second favourite place in the whole world.
Both widowed, Harold and Jean were introduced to each other by a friend in 2021. The two have been inseparable ever since.
I waited 96 years to find the right guy. Wow, better late than ever, right? I mean, it's not just for young people, love, you know. We get butterflies and we get a little action also.
After a modest 1940s-themed reception, next stop for the newlyweds, Paris. For a dinner with Presidents Biden and Macron.
Ella Bicknell. And that's all from us for now, but there'll be a new edition of the Global News Podcast later. If you want to comment on the podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on X at Global News Pod. This edition was mixed by Dan Ehrlich. The producer was Leah McSheffrey. The editor is Karen Martin. And I'm Paul Moss. Until next time, goodbye.